Jack Manson, Operation Death Calling. Written by Tim Simpson. Narrated by Lawrence D. Palmer. Prologue. The rain was mixed with snow as it landed, covering the metal roofing of the warehouse. The sounds that only war can make had begun to decrease as the day turned into night. Inside the warehouse, men and women scrambled about, trying to grab anything and everything that their arms could hold.
"We need to hurry. The Allies will be here soon,"
one of the men said, using his native language. Another man stood in the corner of the room, watching as the warehouse began to empty out.
"We will be tried and convicted for what we have done here,"
the man finally said as he glanced over to a familiar face that also stood in the corner.
"Maybe you will, Doctor, but we are leaving,"
the man said as he inhaled from a non-filtered cigarette.
"And what of my son?"
the man asked as he continued to glare at the Russian man, who now had exhaled the same cigarette.
"He is coming with us. But be warned, Doctor, should any of this reach into the public and any knowledge of our existence be discovered, you will be one of his many victims. Do we understand one another?"
The doctor now removed his eyes from the man. His round face looked to the floor of the makeshift laboratory.
"I did all of this for him,"
he said as he ran a hand over his bald head.
"Keep telling yourself this, Doctor," the Russian said as he dropped his cigarette to the floor.
The cigarette landed at the feet of the bald doctor, and it sparked, causing a reaction from some liquid that had been trailed into the center of the room. The doctor took a step backwards as he watched the flames encircle the entire laboratory. He then turned and was gone out of the small opening that had been concealed behind a bookshelf that contained books of engineering and experimental medical procedures. The doctor walked the long tunnel to its end. He could see the moonlight shining up ahead. He leaned his right shoulder against the tunnel wall. He glanced back over his left shoulder.
"Dear God, what have we done?"
he whispered. He could then hear the sounds of running boots on the pavement just outside of the tunnel. He took a deep breath, then stepped into the night air. Chapter 1. 17 years later. The pier set on the icy water. The sound of the lake breaking against the old wood that held the planks in place creaked with every wave that landed on the sandy bank underneath.
"Both of them, shot in the head.
Ouch,"
one of the men said as he stood staring down at the two men that lay on the pier. Both dead men with lifeless eyes staring into the starless sky.
"Yeah, and look at the powder burns on this one,"
said another man as he stooped down to gain a closer look at the older of the two dead men.
"He was the second one killed," said the kneeling man.
The one still standing took a moment to look around the pier. There was not much here to hide behind. These men must have known this was coming, or so the man thought, as his eyes ran over the surrounding area. He then looked down to the water to where a small motorboat was still sitting.
"No idea either," said the kneeling man as he retook his stance, stretching his lean frame upward.
"A mob thing?" asked the man who was already standing.
"Could be, but we won't know anything until we discover who they are."
Jack Manson turned to face the water.
"There's only one boat,"
he said as he walked to the edge of the pier. The wind had started picking up.
"We need to get the boat to the station and go over it,"
Manson said as he pulled a Chesterfield cigarette from its case.
"Where are the ones that discovered the bodies?"
Manson asked as he turned his face to his longtime partner, Roger York. Roger was a stark contrast to Jack. He was built like a linebacker, whereas Jack was built to replace a scarecrow, if the need should ever arise, that is. Jack was rail thin, his face was hollow and sunken, and his cheeks protruded from his face almost as if his skeleton was trying to break free from its fleshy bonds. He sported a mustache that barely covered his upper lip, which was common for the years that he lived in. Roger was much thicker than Jack and several years younger. He sported a bushy, heavy mustache that gave him a beat cop look, which is exactly what he was before Jack's former partner retired. When Carl retired, Jack did not want another partner. Carl was his mentor when he joined the force straight out of the military. Jack had served on board a ship that had bombed Japan after the fatal sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. Once he returned home, he found that his wife had run off with a vacuum salesman. Distraught, Jack returned to active duty where he signed on to help reconstruction of Hiroshima. It was there Jack had decided he no longer cared to live. He found his way into the mountains with his wife fully on his mind. He wanted to end his life there. She was his world, his reason for living. The thoughts of her got him through the war, and now she was gone, and he could not handle the pain that filled his heart. So there, on the mountain, he wanted to die. However, fate stepped in, and he met an old man who taught him a different path. He showed Jack Manson how to live. After Jack's service was up, he spent 2 years with the old man inside of his dojo. He taught Jack the ways of Aikido and showed him an inner peace that Jack had never known. The old master would often comment that Jack was an old soul and that he was destined to live many lifetimes. Jack never truly understood what the old man meant. However, while Jack was living in those mountains, he would often have dreams of other times and places. Even dreamt once that he was a detective in old England before the turn of the century. But these were just dreams, after all, and he never revealed them to the old man for fear of fueling the old man's perception of the many lifetimes theory. Once Jack returned stateside, he joined the Detroit Police Department where he was spotted by Carl, who quickly began maneuvering Jack into a detective seat. The job fit Jack better than his gloves. He had the logical thinking mind that was needed for the job, the eye of detection. He was a natural, and he was Carl's choice to replace him as lead detective inside the precinct once he had decided to retire. Roger was introduced to Jack only 6 months after Jack took his new office. He could see straightforward that Roger was not meant to be working a beat. Roger was a quick thinker and a good scrapper, and Jack felt comfortable having Roger at his side. Roger was a family man. He had a beautiful wife and a son who had just turned 12 years old. On more than one occasion, Jack had spent some time at the York's home having dinner and on occasion some drinks. Roger now stood beside his friend looking out over Lake Michigan as he reached a hand into his pocket and brandished a notepad. "A Mr. and Mrs. Fremont found the bodies," Roger said as he refolded his pad. "Okay, I want them questioned as soon as we get back to the office. Also, call the boys and have them get this boat out of the water before the storm that is coming in destroys it," Jack said as he adjusted his gray fedora and pulled the collar of his topcoat close around his thin neck. "Let's get out of here," he said as he turned to face the flashing red lights that had begun pulling close to the pier. Standing in the corner, going unseen, stood a figure watching the two detectives as they discussed the two dead bodies. He stood motionless, with a smoking .45 caliber pistol held down by his side. If he would have been seen, there would have been no doubt he was the assassin. His attire would have aided in that assumption. His face was covered by a black and blue mask, with only his eyes showing. He wore a close-fitting costume that looked like it had jumped from the daily newspaper comic strip pages. But he did, in fact, go unseen by all that were present when both murders took place. Chapter 2. He travels unseen through the dark streets of Detroit. He climbs the fire escape that leads to his apartment that he has stolen from his landlord. He slips through the window again, unnoticed. He pulls the blue and black close-fitting mask from his face. He drops it to the floor. The stranger is not from this part of the world. Although he is American by birth, he lived and died in a far-off land. He looks to his right arm. There are two samurai blades, one on the front of his forearm and the other on the rear. They are both connected to his muscles. All it takes is for him to flex, and the blades spring forward ready for action. There is only one on the left arm, and it operates in the same deadly manner. He does not feel human anymore. That is, until he was told to kill the two men on the pier. He had no desire to see either one die, but orders are orders, and he has always followed orders, even before the war. That's when he was nothing more than a private. Then the war broke out, and his rank climbed. Well, that is, until he died. He looked up into the mirror. His face was scarred, and the remains of his many surgeries still lingered over his head and brow. He had some sort of metal plate that surrounded his left eye. It traced its way down to his nose, coming to a point just above his upper lip, which was also stitched. His right eye had a slight red glow about it. It was not his natural eye, of course. No, it was fashioned somehow from mechanics. No matter how hard he tried, he could not remember much of his life before, or how he had so many mechanical parts running through his body. What he could remember was a bright flash, then nothing but red. He remembered waking inside of some sort of hospital. No, not a hospital. It was something else. A warehouse, maybe. He could not feel most of his extremities. He did, however, feel powerful, more powerful than he had ever felt in his life. He remembered going on several missions after that. He was sent to kill hundreds of people. He was good at his job. So good, in fact, that his creators gave him the nickname of Death Calling. Because if he came calling on you, death would follow. He heard the blinds rustle. He looked over his shoulder to see two men coming through the same window in which he had just come. "It's done. We were sent to take you back now," the taller of the two men said as he walked closer to Death Calling.
"No,"
Death Calling said in a voice just above a whisper. "You have no choice. Your job is done here," the older of the two men said as he too began approaching Death Calling.
"Who is Jason?"
Death Calling said as he peered over his shoulder. The two men stopped their approach and shared a glance toward one another. "Where did you hear that name from?" the older man asked.
"It's in my head. Also, Eric. Who are they?"
Again, the two men looked to one another. "Let's go before the police discover you. It was bad enough you left the bodies to be found," the younger man said.
"No, I am not going with you this time."
A third time, the two men looked at one another. "Our boss will not like this, Death Calling."
"Don't call me that. My name is..."
"Come on, let's go talk with the doctors," the old man said. Death Calling turned to face the two men now.
"I do not wish to kill either of you, but I will."
"Okay," said the older man as he slowly slid a hand behind his back. "Let's talk before something bad happens," he said as he felt his fingers come in contact with his pistol that was tucked behind his waistband. But the man known as Death Calling was quick. He was quicker than either man. He engaged all three of his blades by extending his arms, and then he made his attack. Death Calling went for the younger of the two men first. His blade caught the man as he was trying to retrieve his pistol from his pocket. The man's arm fell to the ground before his fingers could grip the handle of the weapon. The older man managed to pull his pistol and fire. However, the bullet went wild in the confusion, and Death Calling managed a hard right cross, sending the man to the floor. The younger man used his left arm to try and retrieve his pistol once again, but this time the killing blow came to his throat as Death Calling swung his blade, catching the man's neck, sending him to the floor, but this time he was dead. The older man pulled his head up from the old carpet. He looked to Death Calling, who was now standing over him, and he said in his thick Russian accent,
"They will send him after you, and then you will be dead."
Death Calling's blade dripped red as he stood over both bodies. He knew he did not have time to dispose of them in the manner in which he was taught. He had to leave them. But he knew others would come, so he would leave a surprise awaiting their arrival. Death Calling tried to conceal his weapons as best he could by wrapping them in bandages. Then he pulled on an overcoat and placed one of the dead men's fedora hats over his head. He then made his way to the window of the small apartment. He looked back one last time. The thoughts were racing inside his mind. Why had he turned on the men that had always came for him? They had always protected him and pulled him from potentially bad situations in which he might have been caught by the authorities. Why would he do this? He had no idea. He was always sent to kill and return, but something happened to him on that pier. He saw the bald man's face, and something happened inside him when he pointed the pistol at the fallen man's forehead. The man looked at him and said something that triggered thoughts. He said one word that caused him to regret his actions. Just one word caused him to kill the closest thing he had to a friend at that moment. The word that will haunt him until he can find the truth of what had happened to him. That word was son. Chapter 3. The night passed quickly for Jack. He was never much for sleeping. In fact, once he left the office for home, he had a specific, albeit unintended, routine. He would walk in through his front door and immediately pull his fedora from his head and place it onto the hall tree that stood to his immediate right. He would then pull his top coat off and place it on the hook just under his hat. As he walked down the narrow hallway of his apartment, he would begin untying his double Windsor knot that was close to his collar. He would then proceed to his kitchen and pour a glass of Scotch whiskey, which would also serve as his dinner. He would take only one sip before shedding his sport coat and placing it on the back of the chair that sat near his unused eating table. Jack would then turn left and go into his bedroom, where he would begin shedding the rest of his clothing, replacing it with silk pajama bottoms and top, covering the ensemble with a burgundy smoking jacket before heading back out into the hallway. He would grab his glass of scotch before moving into his sitting room, where he would stop to wind up his phonograph that stood in the corner. Once the arm was wound tightly on the player, he would give the 78 RPM record a spin, and then Paganini would come to life with the sounds of the violin echoing throughout his dwelling. Jack would then sit in his favorite easy chair and reflect on the day's events with a lit cigarette in one hand and a glass of scotch in the other. Only when his head would nod would he get up to make his way to bed, which was usually around 3 in the morning, in which case he would sleep for 2 hours and get up to begin the day all over. His day, not unlike his night, began the same. He rose up to take his tepid shower. He made his way to his closet to where his 35 white shirts hung in neat fashion. He pushed the shirts from left to right using his right hand to where his gray trousers also hung in the same organized fashion. He would then clothe himself and reach to the hook that hung beside his closet, where the shoulder harness that contained his military-issued M1911 45 caliber pistol hung. Most all other members of the police department were carrying 38 caliber revolvers, but Jack's choice was the one weapon that had saved his life on more than one occasion during the war. The pistol had custom-made grips of ivory, but the rest of the weapon was not overly remarkable since it was the weapon issued to him during the war, and the government did not go out of its way to flash up its combat weapons. Jack would then walk to his small kitchen and start his morning brew of coffee. It was now much easier since the automatic coffee machine hit the market. He would oftentimes glance to the violin that sat in the corner of the eating room, the violin that would go untouched for days. He thought many times that he would never fully grasp the magnificence of the instrument, but he was determined to learn at least one song. The sound of the coffee coming to its conclusion would wake him from his early morning thoughts. He would turn and pour a large, strong cup, taking a sip as he made his way to the door to grab his morning paper. He would sit at his table, sipping the coffee as he pored through the daily news. He would often read the articles by Carl Colvin. Jack knew Carl personally. In fact, Carl was often enlisted by Jack to grab inside information from someone Jack suspected, but the perps were either too crafty or had too good a lawyer for the courts to convict. And the price was reasonable. Carl would do it for an inside exclusive. Jack could care less. All he wanted was justice to be served. Roger, however, protested this arrangement. He argued that Carl was nothing more than a greedy reporter making a name for himself, and at the cost of whoever stood in his way. However, Jack reasoned that since Carl more often than not got results, what difference did it make? Jack was not with Carl socially, as in eating at diners together or having coffee. It was strictly business. Jack had very few friends. In fact, his only real friend was Roger. At exactly 5:45 a.m., Roger was outside of Jack's apartment building waiting in his new Buick. Jack would glance at his watch, stand up, place the paper on the corner of the table. Then he would pick up his cup of coffee and quickly swallow the remains. On his way back down the hallway, he grabbed his gray sports coat and buttoned it before he threw his overcoat over his left arm. Then he would grab his fedora and place it on his head before shutting the door behind him. Chapter 4. Jack Manson's office was in direct contrast to his neat and tidy apartment. It was a very small room. Some even referred to it as the closet. But Jack could not care less. He liked it the way it was. His desk was made from the finest oak that he could find. He had it custom made. He had said that if he was to spend more time behind a desk than at home, he wanted to make it worthwhile. His chair was large and plush, made from a dark brown cow's hide. It sat easy and leaned all the way to where he could rest his legs on the corner of his desk, if he felt so inclined to recline. The top of his desk was always cluttered with paper after paper. Most were cases open or just being closed. He kept a desk full of writing utensils and notepads. Directly behind his chair was a large bookshelf that kept all of the books that he thought would aid him in any given case. The books ranged from medical sciences to courtroom procedures. He prided himself on knowing his craft. There was a small lamp that sat to the right of the desk where most of the desktop papers were pushed. He much rather preferred using the lamp over the overhead lighting. "Hey, Jack, I just got the first report back," Roger said as he came barging in through the open door of Jack's office. "And you're not going to believe this," Roger said as he tossed a manila folder onto the top of the stack of papers that lay on the desktop. Jack reached up and grabbed the folder as he leaned back in his chair. "So tell," he said as he dropped the open folder. "The younger of the two gentlemen was an FBI agent," Roger said as he took a seat in front of Jack's desk. "And he was a darn fine one," said a voice from behind Roger. The sound of the booming vocals made Roger jump from his seat. Jack looked up from his folder to see a man standing in his doorway. "Oh, really? And how would you know that?" asked Jack as he lay the folder back onto his desk. The man reached into the left side of his black coat and pulled a wallet. Then he flipped it open. The badge was unmistakable. It read, FBI. "I am Agent Stone, and I will be handling the investigation from here on out," Stone said as he looked over the small room. Stone was a big, powerfully built man. He sported a small mustache and eyes that were set close together. He was dressed in dark trousers, sport coat, and a dark tie. Believe me when I say that I mean no disrespect, but this is my town, and two murders took place here. I have no idea why an FBI agent was killed, but I do believe that if we pooled our resources together, we could come up with... Mr. Manson, Stone began, causing Jack to look toward Roger with a slight stunned expression at the sound of his name falling from Stone's mouth. Stone continued, I do not care about your resources. I do care, however, about my dead agent, a good agent, my partner, and I will find his killer and bring him to justice, Agent Stone said as he looked between Roger and Jack. I assume you spoke with my superiors, and they have agreed? Yes, Mr. Manson, I have, and the DA fully understands the sensitivity of this case, and should I require any assistance from you, I will get in touch, Stone said just before turning to leave the office. Jack, are you not going to do something? Roger asked as he looked to his partner. Jack leaned back in his chair once again. Roger, they are the FBI. They can make this hard on us. However, I do want to know what's going down in my city, he said as he folded his long fingers together, resting them underneath his narrow chin. I want you to call Carl.
Now, wait a minute, Roger protested. Why do we need to bring him in on this?
Because he is the media and he can snoop where we cannot. And if he gets caught, he can claim freedom of the press. You know this, Roger. Besides, we have to follow orders. The press is not bound by such things as orders, Jack said with a chuckle. Okay, I will call him, but what am I supposed to say? Have him meet us at Tom's Diner at 12:30.
I don't like it. Somehow that idiot always winds up in a huge mess and we have to bail him out.
Now, Roger, you know as well as I, Carl has helped us out on many a case. Jack said with a chuckle at Roger's frustration.
Well, on the plus side, he could get arrested and thrown in jail for messing around an FBI case.
Hey, you know what? Just that thought makes me feel better about it, Roger said as a grin stretched across his chubby face. Chapter 5. Carl Colvin was the quintessential reporter. Most of the time he looked disheveled, as if he had slept in his clothes for days at a time. He was always carrying a 5 o'clock shadow that never seemed to grow any longer and never seemed to be shaved. He was always sporting a crushed brown fedora that set to the back of his head, leaving a tuft of hair sticking out the front. His necktie was always pulled lower than his collar. His blue sports coat was always wrinkled, and the same went for his matching trousers. He was never seen without a camera hanging from his neck or a notepad in his hand. He could have hired a photographer, but then he would have to share credit for any story he wrote, and he was not about to do that. He was 39, and he lived every minute of his bachelor's life to its hilt. When he was not sleeping in his car, waiting for a case, he was courting the most beautiful women that he could get to pay him some attention. He could be loud, he could be obnoxious, and he could get into any of the hottest nightclubs in town. And that is why he was always seen with the prettiest of girls, some as much as 10 years younger than he.
District Attorney, sir, can I have a word?
Carl said as he held his notepad firmly in his hand. Mr. Colvin, I am very busy, District Attorney Sinclair said as he stopped midway up the long steps that led to his office.
But sir, Manny Van Johnson was released yet again. Sir, how is it that this guy, a known racketeer, is allowed to just get out of jail whenever he chooses? And sir,
listen, Mr. Colvin, if Mr. Van Johnson were guilty of any charges, he would be sitting behind bars.
Is that your formal statement, sir?
Good day, Mr. Colvin, was the district attorney's reply as he shuffled up the steps.
You'd better be careful sniffing around the Van Johnsons' family tree.
The voice caught Carl off guard as he was watching the DA disappear behind his office door. He turned quickly. Well, well, Beth Stidham, as I live and breathe.
You keep up after Manny and you won't be,"
said the young woman of 29 as she stepped closer to where Carl was standing on the steps.
"So, you a hitman woman now?"
he asked as he stepped back onto the cobblestone floor.
"Nope, just looking under some of the same stones you are,"
she said as she turned to meet Carl, who had already begun walking toward the building's exit.
"I thought you gave up the reporting business,"
Carl said as he held the door open for the lady to exit first.
"Well, sort of. Actually, I wanted to ask you a question,"
she said as she stopped at the top of the long set of steps that led to the city street.
"Of course I am available for dinner tonight,"
Carl said with a chuckle.
"Keep dreaming, bub. That ship has sailed,"
said Beth with a chuckle.
"But really, I have a source inside the mayor's office, and he said some old Nazi spy washed up on a pier last night, and I thought maybe you knew something of this."
Carl paused a moment before stepping onto the first step.
"I haven't heard anything. If that were true, it would be everywhere, wouldn't it?" "You would think so. So I just figured if anyone was up to speed on Nazis in Detroit, it would be Carl Colvin,"
Beth said as she turned to head down toward the street. Carl remained at the top step as he watched her small frame move downward.
"I will check it now,"
he called out behind her. Beth simply raised a hand in the air as she turned the corner, and just as quickly as she showed up, she was gone.
"That was a strange exchange,"
thought Carl as he adjusted his camera that was still hanging around his neck. Carl walked to his waiting automobile. It was an older car, a 1948 Packard, and he had driven the thing ever since he had left his home state of Illinois. He climbed behind the wheel and turned the ignition, and the old engine rumbled to life. Carl drove back to the Daily News headquarters. He quickly leaped from his car and ran up the stairs to fling one side of the double doors back to make his entrance. The place was constantly buzzing with activity. He made his way around several rows of desks. The sounds of typewriter keys being hit echoed through the building. It even drowned out the sound of papers rustling as copy boys grabbed paper after paper to run them to the printing presses for the afternoon edition.
"Carl, get in here!"
Editor Stephen Dykes yelled from his office upon seeing Carl pass by his large window that looked out into his newsroom. Carl stopped in his tracks and leaned his body backward to look into his boss's office.
"Yeah, boss?"
"Someone from the precinct has been trying to call you. Did you get into trouble again last night? Because if you did, I..."
"No, nothing like that. Anyway, did you hear about some Nazis washing up on shore?"
"What are you talking about, Colvin?"
Never mind. Did the cock believe a name?"
"Yeah, a Roger something."
"York?"
"Yeah, that's him."
"Okay, thanks, boss,"
Carl said as he disappeared around the corner. Carl no sooner stepped into his office when his phone had begun to ringing.
"Carl Colvin's desk,"
he said into the black receiver.
"Carl, this is Roger. Jack wants to speak with you at Tom's in, let's say, an hour."
Carl looked at his watch.
"All right, but he's buying,"
Carl said as he placed the phone back into its cradle. Carl hasn't heard from Jack in a while. What could he want? He thought as he leaned on his elbows over his desk. Then he looked to his left, where the small mail basket was sitting. An envelope was laying therein. Carl reached over and lifted the envelope from the wire basket. He opened the center drawer on his desk and pulled out a letter opener that was shaped like a switchblade knife. He then pulled a letter from the envelope. He unfolded the expensive-looking paper and read the contents. There were only two words typed in the center of the paper. They read, "Back off." Chapter 6. Jack Manson and Roger York were already seated at the table inside Tom's restaurant when Carl entered. Carl casually walked to the side of the table. He then turned toward the counter and said,
"Can I get the usual, Tom?"
"You got it, Carl,"
came Tom's reply.
"So, what's shaking, boys?"
Carl said as he fell into his seat. Roger looked to Jack with a disparaging gleam in his eye.
"All right, Carl, here is the gist," Jack began as he ignored Roger's look. "Two guys were found on the pier last night, and now the FBI is blocking the local police department, and..." Carl suddenly straightened up in his chair.
You have got to be kidding me, he said.
You already know of this? Asked Jack as he looked over to Roger, who just shrugged his shoulders.
Yeah, in fact, you remember Beth Stidham?
Yes, Jack answered.
She came to me about this. She had someone on the inside at the mayor's office. She said something about a Nazi,
Carl said as he lowered his voice to receive his ham on rye with a side of potatoes from Jennifer, the waitress. Jack sat back in his chair. This is incredible. I am not so sure about the Nazi angle, but I do want to know why the FBI suddenly shut us down. Can you dig and find out? Asked Jack.
Well, I can dig and ask around, but I'm not sure I will be able to produce any more than you guys,
Carl said as he took a bite of his sandwich. Well, just do what you can and we will keep in touch, Jack said as he slid from his seat.
Hey, I thought you was buying,
Carl said, looking toward Jack. It's on Roger today, Jack said as he turned to leave before Roger could protest. Several seats away, two men sat listening. Both were strangers to Michigan and even to America.
Did you hear that, comrade?
One said in a low whisper.
They are only local law. They will produce nothing we need to find the stone. He is the key to finding Jason,
said the other foreigner.
But these local police can cause us great trouble. All right, then. Put Volchek on them, if that will make you feel better,
said the older of the two men.
Yes, but we need to make sure he will not do anything stupid as before. He has such a temper these days.
Yes, I know. We will let Volchek follow the locals.
We need to find our other comrades. They should have brought Jason back by now.
Do you think they are still living?
After all, death calling can be hard to handle sometimes,
said the younger of the two men.
I don't know. I did not get the address to the apartment where he would be retrieved. Then let us continue our search so that the doctor will not send any more of his freaks after us.
Agreed, comrade. Agreed.
The water slowly rolled into the shoreline. The lake was a majestic masterpiece that seemed to be painted by the great creator himself. It was a natural body of fresh water that could pass as an ocean when the winds were up. The small fishing boat thumped against the side of the fishing dock as the cool winter wind blew flurries of snow into the small boat. On the bank, very near to the water, sat a small shanty. It was once a little dream home of a couple that lived near Manistee, Michigan. They would travel down to this remote part that set just on the outskirts of Detroit, and they would fish for silver bass and other lake life. But as the years drew on, the couple grew older and died. Now the shack sat empty with weeds and with unkempt foliage now taking over. It looked ghostly with its dark pane windows covered with years of neglect. The wood had all but rotted, and what insulation there was left between the walls had mostly fallen from the enormous cracks left by the splitting wood siding. But he did not care. Death Calling stood, looking out the muddy filth that was the window. He could barely make out the shape of the water as it waved at him from just a few feet away. They would be coming for him soon. He had betrayed them, and they would never forgive him for what he had done. He stood, peering through his dark mask that covered his head and face, looking out into that vast body of water, wondering when his time would be up. He didn't care. He should have died years ago on that battlefield. Somehow he knew he should have died, but he did not. And now he was wanted by the Americans, and now by the Russians, and whoever else was associated with his handlers. He was indeed a dead man. Again. Death Calling turned from the window. He knew he would never be able to leave. There is nowhere he could go that he would not draw attention. His people were the only ones that could move him from place to place, undetected. Now he had no one looking out for him. Why had he felt the need to kill the two that were the ones that aided him? It was the old man on the pier. The face looked familiar somehow. His last word was son. What did that mean? Was he referring to the dark man that killed him? He didn't know anything, and nothing was making sense to him now.
He had never had to reason anything out before. He was just given orders and he carried them out. But this was different. Should he stay and discover more about who he really is? Or should he run and let them come after him again? He knew they would never stop. He had to face them, but he could never get to where they are. They will have to come to him. He looked back toward the window. The sun was starting to slowly set. It will happen soon, and it will be all over the news. Soon everyone will know something big is coming to Detroit. Or so he thought. Chapter 7. Jack Manson sat behind the wheel of his service vehicle when his radio came alive with activity.
All available units report to 105 12th Street. Two possible homicides.
Jack looked to Roger.
Should we go?
Roger asked. It could be related, Jack said.
Well, if it is, the FBI will be there. And I don't know about you, but that Agent Stone fellow is kind of a creepy guy,
Roger added. Let's go and see, Jack said as he spun his car around and headed back in the opposite direction in which he was traveling. Manson pulled the car to its destination. The street was a buzz of activity. Uniformed police officers were already at the scene, keeping bystanders away from the apartment building. Lights were flashing everywhere the eye could see. Jack and Roger stepped from their vehicle. Jack looked to Roger over the roof of the car. Assist the officers, and I will run in real quick. I need a look before Agent Stone gets wind of this, Jack said as he hurried toward the entrance to the building. The tail of his long overcoat blew in the breeze behind him as he stepped through the archway that led into the building. He paused for a moment to flash his homicide badge at the officer that was standing guard just outside of apartment 9. Hey, fellas, we know who they are yet? Manson asked as he walked up to the first plainclothesman he saw. Hey, Jack. No, not yet. No ID on them. Jack looked toward the two men. Yeah, I've seen that one before. Oh, and Jack, one of them had his arm cut off. Jack shot a sideways glance to the man in which he was talking. His arm? What kind of man are we dealing with here?
What are you doing?
Agent Stone said as he pushed past two uniformed officers. Jack Manson turned to see Stone moving towards him. It looks like a homicide has taken place here, Manson said as he watched Stone grab a uniformed man by the arm.
I want this man and all other local men out of this building now, Stone said to the uniformed officer.
Across the room at a writing table, Sergeant Harold was dusting for prints when he heard Stone's command. He turned away from the table until he heard the sound of what appeared to be a clock ticking, but there was no clock on the table. He turned back to see what it was that was making the noise. Nothing on top, he thought. He looked back to where Manson and Stone were still arguing. Then he slowly glanced underneath the table.
Gentlemen, we have a situation over here, Harold said.
Stone and Manson both ceased their argument and turned to face Harold. Harold then peered at what he assumed was a ticking bomb, and the time said 15 seconds was left.
Get everyone out, now!
Stone shouted as he grabbed Manson and held him close to his body, all the while turning his back toward the explosion that rocked the entire building. Manson felt the force of the explosion against he and the agent. The sound was deafening. He felt the heat as the blast forced him out the ground floor window. He landed hard. He could feel his coat had caught fire. His mind was a daze of confusion. That's when he noticed Stone was laying beside him. Jack was having trouble hearing. And then slowly he could make out the sounds of sirens as they wailed for bystanders to stand out of their way. Then he felt his arm being struck, and he looked to his right to see Roger putting out some flames that was still smoldering on his cuff.
Jack! Jack! Can you hear me?
Roger shouted. Jack looked up, but he could only read the words on Roger's lips.
I think so, Jack said as he tried to push himself to a sitting position.
He could then see several men in white running with stretchers in hand as they lay one beside what was left of Agent Stone.
Is anyone else alive?
Jack asked, as he tried shaking the explosion from his head.
I don't see how, Roger said as he helped a couple of men ease Jack onto his stretcher. Across town, the noise was not heard by Carl Colvin, who was standing at a darkened alleyway.
Look, Carl, if you are wanting any more on Manny, forget it. He is too big now. He will crush me without a thought, said the little man.
Relax, Mole. It's not about him. I need to know about the guys that were found on the pier last night. What do you know?
Mole, as he was called, looked just like his name. He was short, with an oversized nose and a small mustache underneath that could have been mistaken for whiskers, and wore an oversized suit since there was not many that would fit his small frame. Mole had a name in the underworld that also fit his moniker. He was able to get into any situation and find out all sorts of information before leaving, and he was paid well by a lot of people for doing this. People from all walks of life employed the small man to gather all sorts of information. However, Carl had known him longer than anyone. Mole was set up by a businessman. He framed the mole in a murder case, and because of Carl's investigative reporting, the mole was acquitted of all charges.
Oh, funny you should ask about those guys, began Mole as he reached into his pocket to pull out a cigarette. That's the buzz all over town now. Rumor is, one was a mad scientist or something, the other a Fed. The mad doctor was hiding, and the Fed was supposed to be guarding him when they were both done in by an assassin that has everyone nervous around here. Everyone is trying to keep their mugs tight on this one.
How did you hear about all of this? Asked Carl as he flashed a spark from his Zippo lighter to light Mole's cigarette. Mole paused to puff his cigarette to life.
I was listening to the conversation between two foreign men. It was just outside of a diner downtown. They were talking about the feds and looking for someone. I couldn't hear who. Maybe the guy that did them in. I don't know. Then when I brought it up to Johnny the Lips Malone, he said that he heard that Jake the Rat was down by the pier where the two mugs got it. The Rat said that the two men exited a boat. Then gunfire came from behind the old man's watcher's cabin that set off to the side of the pier. The big man fell dead with a slug in his head. The other one dropped to his knees. That's when the man showed himself. He was creepy looking. That's all the Lips and the Rat had to say about him. The old man pleaded for his life. Then he was shot in the head also. Then two guys in suits showed up. One of them looked to the creepy man and said, "Go wait for us. We will meet up later." That's when they took their wallets. Rat also said that they left when they heard cars coming. It was the old man and his wife coming back to the cabin.
Mole took a long drag from his cigarette. Why did the Rat not tell the police any of this?
Are you kidding? They are looking for him for a burglary charge, and he ain't saying nothing.
Okay, Mole, you did good on this one. Where can I find this Rat fella?
I'm not sure. I think he hangs out at Lip's place a lot.
And where is that?
It's the hottest spot near 10 Mile. You can't miss it.
Thanks, Mole. And here, buy you a sandwich, man. You look terrible, Carl said as he handed the Mole a dollar.